Blog Talk Radio.
You're listening to author G.D. Grace's A Touch of Grace, Literary Magic, on Blog Talk Radio.
People of the world, I'm your host, GD. Welcome to Queens Presents on A Touch of Grace. Today's date is Sunday, the 24th of August, and the time is 1:30 p.m. Where is this year going? I have to tell you, we're already halfway through. Addiction. In its earliest stages, it presents the high as a euphoric feeling grander than the gold dazzling streets in heaven above. After that first incredible hit, the chase begins, and eventually the cruelty of what lies behind the silver mask is revealed in a melee of broken promises, reckless escapades, and chronic absenteeism from everyday life. Without as much as a compassionate sigh, it consumes a spirit, leaving in its wake an incomprehensible demoralization so compelling it replaces everything you were with the travesty of what you have become. And as your sound mental state disintegrates, the obsession overtakes better judgment, and it ridicules the emptiness that engulfs the soul. In recovery, there are 12 steps and 12 traditions that light the way, and it's only when we surrender that we find a power that we come to believe can restore us to sanity. Sometimes quickly, sometimes slowly, we make amends and identify our character defects, and it is then that we ride the tide of recovery, recouping some of what we lost in the bowels of active addiction. Laura Poindexter, the soul writer, entered through the doors or the corridors of a new life, leaving behind a wretched existence she once lived. And today she joins me on Queens Presents to shed light, hope, and purpose on the lives of others during this broadcast. Laura Poindexter, welcome to A Touch of Grace. How are things going with you today?
Things are wonderful with me today, and I am just elated to be here sharing the mic with you, Brother Grace. I'm excited.
Well, I tell you one thing. I am honored to have you on the show, and I've been reading some of your stuff. You have the soul of a queen. And I just want to say, my sister, the segment is appropriately titled today because you most definitely are a queen.
Amen. Amen. I thank you for that. And it's that realization that helps keep me sober, I guess. We don't realize what we are internally because of all the external stuff. And so when you shake that off and get to the essence of self, honey, it is wonderful, sugar.
Oh, wonderful. Well, you know what? I can hear you say it's wonderful, sugar, over and over again, because I tell you right now, you know, I am honored to be sharing this space with you today. So for the listeners who tuned in today, tell us a little bit about your early life, where you grew up, and who grew up with you in your home environment.
Oh, absolutely. I come from a two-parent household. I'm originally from New York, Harlem in the building. I have one younger sibling, and we had pretty much a healthy, happy, but compared to what, as Roberta Flack says, family for the most part. And my mother passed away when I was 6 years old. She had a brain aneurysm. And at that point in time, life for my family changed dramatically. And I had to relocate to move with my grandmother, my paternal grandmother, my sister and myself, and my dad pretty much lost it. And he lost his wife. And that was the moment that life, the way I viewed life, it changed for me. And because my family was ill-equipped to deal with the devastation, most African-American families, especially back then, we didn't do a lot of therapy. We didn't talk about a lot of stuff. We just push on, as most African-Americans do. We push on, and not realizing that without resolve, we push on, but it gets heavier and heavier and harder to push without any resolve. And not having any resolve behind my mother's death was probably the beginning of the end for me. You know,
wow. Well, you know what? This goes into the next question, and it's perfect. So how confident were you as a teenager, and were there any adversities you faced after your mother's passing that altered your path for better or for worse?
Oh, absolutely. I was 6 years old, and my sister was 3 years old. I was very, very young. I did understand death. I knew she wasn't coming back. I was clear about that. And that created a devastation for me. And I believe that if I could have used drugs at 6 years old, I probably would have. I started using at around 9 years old, drinking at 9 years old, and it became progressively worse over the years. Cocaine was my drug of choice, but my mother's death changed my life for the worst, and I couldn't cope with her death. I couldn't cope with it, and drugs provided me with a way to escape and not think about it and be invincible and not feel. And so drugs were reliable. Drugs did exactly what they said that they were going to do. They were going to get me high. And because I was so confused about what everything else was questionable after my mother's death. Mm-hmm. But drugs, they were right on. They did what they said they was going to do, brother.
In the beginning, they always do what they say they're going to do, you know, until they start revealing exactly who they are. So I want to make sure I understand. So you were 9 years old when you started using?
I was 9 years old, and I started drinking at 9, and I was smoking marijuana at 12, and I first used cocaine at 14 years old.
And so do you remember the exact place and moment in time, where you were when you did that first line or took that first toke?
Absolutely. I was at a Rick James concert.
Oh, no, you didn't say that.
Yes, I was. I was at a Rick James. I will never forget it. And I was dating a gentleman that was much older than myself, and he was a drug dealer, so that was a good match for me. And we went to a Rick James concert, and I never forget that. The first time I inhaled cocaine, things just physiologically changed for me. I was confident. I was happy. I was exuberant. It was love at first. It was love at first too.
Mm-hmm.
It was no doubt about that. I was gonna get me some more of this.
Mm-hmm.
It was no doubt about. Yeah, it was just crazy how it altered me, and I didn't understand. I was 14 years old, and at 14 years old, I wasn't even fully developed mentally,
mm-hmm.
spiritually, physically, psychologically. I was still growing. So using that type of drug was just, it just really, really laid a very, very fragmented foundation for a number of years in my life.
Mm. It's so ironic that you mentioned the Rick James concert, because Rick James, that's pretty much what took him out, is just a lifetime of substance abuse using cocaine. And I got a chance to see a bio, I think it was TV1 Unsung, where they were talking about his life. Actually, it was VH1, and it really took him to some dark places. So one thing that we know as being in recovery is that the drugs don't care who you are. You could be rich as all get out, or you could be as poor as they come. And it, when it grabs a hold of you, it grabs a hold of you. So what I want to dive into a little bit is life without a drug deal, life with a drug dealer. How did you meet this drug dealer, and what was it about him besides the drug that captivated you?
Well, as I said before, I'm from Harlem, and people had migrated to Harlem to have a better life. And for some, that did happen, and for many, probably the majority, that did not happen. And so living in Harlem, you see two sets of people, but the bigger or more vivid picture comes from the people who are drug dealers, because they have the pretty cars and they wear the fur coats and they have the
mm-hmm.
jewelry, and that vision is bigger. The working stiff or the average Mary or Joe, they just don't resonate within your psyche as much. And so I was attracted to that, and it didn't help that my father also, after my mother passed away, became a drug dealer, and he was a very notorious drug dealer in Harlem.
Wow. Well, you know, I had Francine Lucas on the show. She's actually an American Gangster's Daughter is the book that was just released and the upcoming film. Her father actually was the notorious Frank Lucas, and her whole life just changed. She wound up having to go to witness protection. So in this life, what were some of the worst times that you saw?
Wow. Oh, gosh. My life was surrounded by seeing things that were extremely violent and egregious. And oddly enough, I only can now say that they were, because at the time of the occurrence, it happened all the time. So it wasn't that shocking or stunning, which is very sad. And that is what happened, what's happening now within the inner city. I was very numb to people overdosing. I was very numb to people being carjacked. I was very numb to drive-bys. I was very numb to driving up and down 95, buying kilos of coke. I was very numb. That was a regular day in my life. So what did I see? The question is probably, what didn't I see? And as a result, my dad died from a cocaine-induced stroke. His brother died from a heroin overdose. Their father died from cirrhosis of the liver. I am 29 years in recovery, and unfortunately, my son right now, at this present day, is dealing with an opiate addiction. So what didn't I see?
Yeah, that's incredible. Okay, so now you're seeing the mayhem that drugs are doing from a dealer's perspective, but then also from a user's perspective. So you have been clean for 29 years. So what was that moment like when you realized and you looked around and you saw all of this darkness that you were in? What do you remember that moment in time where you said, you know, Laura, I have had enough?
Oh, gosh, it was so many moments at times. But let me tell you, Brother Grace, I physically, my family, because I live in Maryland now, my family had gotten a word about how bad I was doing, because at my bottom I was pretty much living in a crack house, and I was doing anything I needed to do to get high, because one thing I was going to do is I was going to get high. I really didn't care about how I was going to get high, but that was going to happen. And so my family from Maryland came to New York and physically forced me in a car, physically, and brought me to Maryland. I actually went into a treatment center, and I only stayed for a day. And my aunt was like, you have two choices. You have two choices. Well, no, three. You can die. You can take the help that we're trying to offer you, or you can live out this meager existence. And so I did want to do it, and I opted to actually do it spiritually. And I had never been in church so much in my life. I tell you, Grace, I was in church Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, Saturday, Sunday. Praise Jesus.
Praise Jesus.
That is how I actually got my recovery foundation. Once I got my land legs back on and started learning how to live again, I can honestly say I was abstinent for the first 10 years of my life, but I was never in recovery. So I've been abstinent. Let me clarify. I've been abstinent from drugs for 29 years. I've been in recovery for 19 years because I was crazy as a bat out of Hades for the first 10 years abstinent because I did not know how to live my life. I did not know how to live life on life's terms.
Mm-hmm. And sometimes that's the hardest part for a recovering addict. And a lot of the times that is what leads an addict into addiction, because we can't accept life on life's terms, you know, and we are self-centered and we feel like we're the only ones that actually have a problem. So you sort of touch basis on the first few years. So what was early recovery like? You said it got crazy. What was that crazy? What did that craziness look like? What did it sound like? What did it smell like?
Oh, gosh. Early recovery for me was pretty much of a woe is me type of situation. I looked at life as a personal, life was a personal vendetta. And what I used as my scapegoat, or this is the thing that validates all of the craziness that I'm saying, is that my mother died when I was 6 years old, as if I was the only one who had experienced that. There are so many people who have suffered that type of loss, but I personalized everything, Brother Grace. It was, you're out to get me. You mean me no good. Why is this happening to me? Like, poor Laura. And I would lash out. I was very abrasive to folk. I pretty much had a reputation of somebody who, you know, she's unpredictable. I was very unpredictable. And what I noticed is that my personality was one of never can get enough. And if something made me feel good, even if it wasn't the drugs, a man, food, anything that made me feel good, I obsessed over that thing. So I realized that I had some personality disorders that I really needed to work on, and I finally got a job, and I got a job in the field, health and human services, working very low level, actually, as a cleaning person. And the receptionist was pregnant, and the clinical director said, Laura, can you do anything else? I said, what do you mean, can I do anything? Can you do anything else? Because the secretary, she's going out on maternity leave, I don't know. And it just happened for me, and that was my first receptionist job, and that's how I first started working in the field. And working in the field, I got to see myself from the other side of the desk.
Mm. Okay. And so that's a good, that leads to this question. So when you got a chance and an opportunity to see yourself from the other side of the deck, what did it trigger in you?
I sincerely wanted to change, and not just from a verbal proclamation, but from a work, standpoint. I wanted to actually start the stages of change. I wanted to actually now hear what people were saying about me, opposed to listening and reacting. I wanted to hear, and I wanted to ponder. I wanted to process. And I actually wanted to see, because, you know, if 5 or 6 or 7 or 8 people say it's an apple tree, Laura, it pretty probably is an apple tree. So I really wanted to start to take things not so personally and start to internalize, because I sincerely wanted to become a better person.
Mm-hmm. And in your encounters and experiences, and by the way, I just want to let you know, a lot of people have joined us today, and we'll take some calls a little later in the show. I want to thank the people for tuning in today here on A Touch of Grace Queens Presents with the remarkable woman, phenomenal woman, Laura Poindexter, who is talking about her life in addiction and in recovery, and she's also a poet as well. So we're going to talk a little bit more and get more into Laura Poindexter. So I want to talk about this 18 years in altruistic community leader and social services profession within the city of Baltimore. So what are the characteristics of that role, and why was it ideal for you? I think I kind of know, but I want to hear it in your own words.
Being able to see that I was not alone, not that I was happy that anyone else was suffering, let me be clear, but from the other side of the desk, I was able to see that I was not an isolated incident. That created compassion in me. It created a larger understanding and a want, a desire to not only be better, but to be present for people who were going through the same thing. Because remember, one of my issues was that I felt like I didn't have anybody. So now I'm a body that has had that same experience. And so it was my opportunity now to be present for people who I could clearly see were experiencing the same thing. So I jumped in that with all of my passion and all of my heart, and I fell in love with human services and fell in love with being an addictions counselor and a mental health practitioner. I fell in love with it, and I was just totally in my element.
Mm-hmm. So in this human services profession, which I see as a humanitarian effort, because there are so many sick people mentally who, even if they aren't using substances, you know, they're walking around with a lot of resentment and a lot of uncertainties and, you know, insecurities from things that they've experienced in childhood. And so what we know and have learned so far about Laura Poindexter today is that her mom died when she was very young, and then she had a father who was pretty much distraught and a grieving type of person who went into selling drugs. Laura herself actually dealt with a drug dealer. First sniff of cocaine was at, you know, around the time she went to a Rick James concert. So with all of the experience you have as being one who was using and abusing drugs in the human services profession, I know that you have seen a lot more. What do you see as the common thing lacking in the lives of people in the struggle?
I think that community-wise, society-wise, we have a point of view that people do not want to do any better. I think that our ability to actually see where they're coming from is maybe blocked by our own personal struggles or maybe is that, you know, people can do whatever they put their mind to, and I completely buy into that. But at its very core, we are talking about a progressive disease that alters your chemical. You become someone that you never thought you would be in a million years, and the more you use, the more progressive it becomes. And that person actually morphs into something else, and it's a long way back home.
Mm-hmm.
It's a long way back home, Grace. And I think that we are not really looking as deep as we should. We see the dirtiness. We see the cunning or manipulative behavior and the way that they act and the outbursts. And those things are very off-putting. And those behaviors can make us say, look, I just don't want to deal with it. But if you look a little bit closer, you would see somebody crying for help.
Mm. So this is a good question, then. I love how you put that. How do you deal with the failures in others and the disappointment? And you think you've got somebody, you think they're on the right track, but as we know, relapse is questionable. Is it part of recovery or is it not part of recovery? How do you deal with that? And I know that you've dealt with it more than one time, especially being in that profession where you see someone one day when they walk in, you see them going through the program, and they get out and you see them again and they have used again. So how do you deal with that to keep yourself on point?
Oh, gosh. it becomes very personal for me. And one thing that they tell us in the field is that you cannot become personally involved with your clients. So I understood that concept. I understood that philosophy, but I still was able to become personally involved in terms of disclosure. I was okay with disclosure. Some counselors actually just, they were like, Laura, I don't know how you do it. But I was okay with that because in the suffering person's mind, they are at a very low point. And earlier in the interview, I said I could see myself on the other side of the desk. And so what I allowed them to do was I allowed them to see me on the other side of the desk. When I disclosed, they said, Miss Laura, Miss Laura. And when I was able to open up and be who I was and share all that I had gone through, it allowed us to bond in an intimate way that was actually taboo. It is actually taboo to counsel the way that I counsel, but I've had a lot of success, and I would not have changed anything that I did, and that's how I dealt with it. But there were some days that I was burnt. I was burnt out. There were some clients that I was like, are you stalking me? I've worked at 6 different mental health substance abuse centers, and you have been a client at each and every one at least twice. Are you stalking me? They'd be like, you know, so there were some days when frustration would build in, even some days where I felt like maybe I'm not doing a good enough job or maybe it's something else that I can do. But we have to remember the disease is progressive, but treatment always has to catch up.
That's profound. And so from a family and friend perspective, dealing with somebody that is actively using, what are, for the listeners today, what are some of the common mistakes that family and friends make when trying to, quote, unquote, help a person who is addicted?
Oh, gosh, that's an excellent question. I'm dealing with that right now with my son, but we can go the codependent route because we love that person and we knew that person before the addiction. So in knowing someone or raising someone or giving birth to someone or going on picnics with someone or having an intimate relationship and laughing and loving someone and to see what drugs have turned them into, you will never, ever fall in love with the addict. You will always be in love with that original person, but they are not that person. And so you are trying to help the original person and not the person that is in front of you. You have to change and understand who you are now dealing with. See, Susie was okay with, come on in, baby, and I'm a, come on, we going, no. Susie is mean now. Susie got a gorilla on her back. And so because we are trying to help the original person, we miss some of the identifiers and some of the primary or core things that we need to be doing to treat the addict man.
You said that so profoundly. We never fall in love with the addict. We fall in love with the original person. So what are some of the suggestions that you have if there's a listener out there who is dealing with someone who is addicted? What is a couple of suggestions that you have for them in order for them to be able to get off the track of enablers into the track of where they're still able to live their life and just letting the addict make the decision for themselves?
First is that you shouldn't blame yourself. It is nothing that you did wrong. I made the choice to use drugs. My son made the choice to use drugs. And in us feeling guilty about maybe having a misstep along the way, that guilt will allow us to give in to the manipulation. It is not your raising kids or children or family members doesn't come with a handbook. And if you know in your heart that you've done the best you can with all that you've had, do not bear the burden of the addiction because it is too heavy. If you're going to support the person, then you cannot bear the burden of their addiction. Okay, that's the first thing. Shake off the guilt so that you will have the strength that you need to walk with them on this journey. And oftentimes, you're going to have to lean away from the situation as well. Why don't they want to get some help? I don't understand. Why you want to? No, you don't understand. They don't understand either, so they're not going to be able to answer that question, ladies and gentlemen. If they understood, then they would have stayed in the last treatment center you put them in or the first three that you put them in before this one. They don't understand either. Sometimes we must lean back and say, I'm here if you need me, when you need me. When you get ready, I'll be there for you. But sometimes we must lean back from that situation because ain't no need for us to be in the crack house with them mentally. They right. in the crack house physically. We in the crack house mentally. Everybody's going crazy, and it is just a ball of confusion. Somebody must be stable in this plan of recovery.
Somebody must be stable in this plan of recovery. So let's talk about the ultimate sacrifice that people make in this disease, because it is progressive, and death. How much death have you seen standing on the other side of that deck of cards?
Oh, my God. Oh, God. In addition to working in the field for about 18 years, I elected to open my own recovery house. Recovery First, and on our third year anniversary, I did a excuse me.
It's all right.
I wanted to do a candlelight ceremony for the women and the people that we had lost 3 years. And after 150 candles, we still had more names. In 3 years. And it just, it was discriminatory. It had nothing to do with the age or race or religion or socioeconomic. It had nothing to do. Drugs do not discriminate. The disease does not discriminate. That was just for me and for the people who were present at the ceremony. It was just very, very heavy, but it shook us to our very core to see that in 3 years we lit 150 candles, but we still had more names on the list. Mm. Mm.
And so in the midst of that desolence, the aftermath, the failed, that were not able to pull themselves and keep themselves out of using, where or how did you find that light to keep on living with some type of joy?
Because you got to live for the living. You got to live for the living. You got to live for the living so we won't run out of candles next time. I had to live for the living.
Uh-huh.
As heavy as it was, there's still some sisters and brothers out there that need a shot of hope. And those are the people that no matter how heavy it gets, I got to show up. I got to show up.
And there are a lot of avenues out there for people if they want to get help. And this is the addict themselves as well as the families dealing with the addict. And so there's a lot of help. I actually joined a facility that I actually take calls just like you. I actually deal with people who call in and they're high, and I'm trying to actually get them in programs. And I know that insurance usually is an obstacle for a lot of these people getting help. So in your recovery house, what types of avenues do you make open or available or find to get people the treatment that they need? Because I know that some people coming off of heroin and alcoholism and some of these things, you know, withdrawal can actually be a death sentence too. So how did you go about opening avenues to actually get the treatment part that is necessary for people who are addicted to drugs or alcohol that could kill them when they're withdrawing?
Well, actually, just for clarity, you know, I've been writing now for about 3 years, and I don't work in the field now. Anything that I do as a contractor. But let me tell you, Brother Grace, I was a bulldog, and I went from that being that front desk receptionist to being program manager, program director, lobbying in Annapolis, drug court coordinator for the state of Maryland. I was a bulldog, and I learned about the laws, and I learned about insurance, and I learned what I needed to do. You're not telling me you're not going to give these people treatment. So I got straight. Let me let ladies and gentlemen, hi, allow me to digress. I was straight hood, but I knew the law. I knew the law, and I made it my business to understand the law of the land, because if you understand the language that they speak.
Right.
And I had to marry that. I had to marry that concept, because if a person comes in with no insurance, a lot of the lists that they give you and places to call, we're booked, Laura. We have a waiting list. And so I made it my business to create and establish personal relationships with Johns Hopkins, personal relationships with Mercy Hospital, personal relationships with recovery houses. So when I called, my people would always get treated. So I was dedicated to this thing. I was a dope fiend for treatment. I was a dope fiend for health and human services. That was my passion, man. When I got up in the morning, I loved going to work. I was the first one there in the morning. I was the last one to leave at night. I understand that people work because they have to make a living, but you dealing with human cargo, so you have to have some passion. And so when they say, I don't have no beds, okay, thank you so much, but I got somebody else to call because I don't know what's going to happen if I let Jane or John Doe leave out that door when they're looking at me saying, Miss Laura, I'm ready. Miss Laura, I'm ready right now, Miss Laura. I need some help. And so I made it my business to connect with people that could pull strings. I was passionate about what I did, and I never took no for an answer because I didn't take no for an answer when somebody told me I couldn't get no crack because I was short.
You know, thank God for bulldogs like you. I don't see you as a bulldog. I see you, I think about Maya Angelou's poem, is it the arch in her back or the stride in her step? Mm. Phenomenal woman, phenomenally. Mm. I've got tears in my eyes just saying that about someone as wonderful as you, who went from being selfish to be so selfless in your fight to help other people. So would you say, and then we'll move forward into the writing part of this and all the great things that you're doing now post the experiences that you had.
Post-apocalypse.
So did you see the money thing where the wealthy were still more privileged than the poor as far as health care?
Oh my goodness. It was so imbalanced. It was such an imbalance, not just the health care, the facilities where you could get care, and how it was so difficult for me to connect my clients with a place here called Massey. In Massey, they have deer and streams and waters and ducks, and the food is like a five-star. It was so imbalanced. And then to be able to be grateful and say, God, I'm glad I got a bed, but I got a bed for a client in an environment where when the client rolls out of the bed and looks out her room window, they selling crack right outside of the treatment center. Oh, yeah.
Lord Jesus.
Where you're putting people in places where I would physically have to take my lunch where they are, because I know they get lunch and they get that half an hour to come outside and sit and eat with them. And they'd be like, Ms. Law, I'm glad you're here. But I already know what's up. I already know what's going on. But there is a huge imbalance. I can't say definitively if that has changed at all. And that is probably something that bothers me the most. We are dealing, again, and I don't mean to be repetitive in my speaking, but it needs to be said, we are dealing with progressive issues, progressive mental health, progressive substance abuse within an antiquated system, and nobody is making any effort. And if we change the system, our recidivism rates and our retention ratios would increase dramatically.
Oh, amazing, amazing. Well, this is what I want to do. We have people waiting, so I want to take a few calls. Are you up to it?
Absolutely.
All right, well, let's go ahead and start with the one who's been waiting the longest. 215-883, you are on with Laura Poindexter and GD. Do you have a question? Great. Okay, so this is what's happening right now. My internet connection is doing something weird. So here, bear with me just a moment. Here, I'm going to try to do something here to kind of correct this. It happens all the time. So, Laura, we're going to talk about your writing as I get this together so that we could actually be able to speak to someone and I could actually get them off of hold.
Absolutely. So, I understand, yeah, brother.
Yeah, I tell you right now, these internet connections drive me crazy. And so, and me trying to get somebody off hold, it's just, okay, so I want to talk about this piece real quick. So after your years of sobriety, people think that it is you ride off into the sunset and you're happy and you're contained. But life shows up and it caused you to become dismayed with your existence. What happened?
Oh, gosh, I was just riding that. I was riding that wave, honey. I was on the cloud. I was doing well. In terms of, and I want everybody to understand, in my mind, I wanted to fit the stereotypical perception of what happiness was. So when you do that, you are devoid of joy. Joy and happiness are two things entirely different. And so I was very happy. Again, I had a lot of material things. I could do whatever I wanted. I could go wherever I wanted. I was helping people. I thought that, hey, I'm helping people. I'm a good person. And I simultaneously, it's like God threw a big old rock through my glass house, shattered every window and every door, and I had to look at myself in that, in the pieces, in the fragmented pieces. Loss of job, loss of a husband, foreclosure on my homes, repossession of my cars, all of my credit cards maxed out, and all of these things over a 3-year time, I was just losing everything and losing everything. And I couldn't, with all of my resumes, all of my skills, letters from governors, letters from senators, attesting to the fact that this lady gets the job done, I could not get hired. I could not get hired. And in addition to that, the way that I lost my job, it was surrounded by scandal. And so I was a very high-profile employee at my job, and my clinical director was male. And he came on to me over a course of a number of years. And in my fourth year, I reported him. I reported him to the executive director, and all hell broke loose. All hell broke loose. And so I was blacklisted to some extent. It was just a lot of scandal surrounding it. And I, once again, just like with the death of my mother, I couldn't understand what was happening to me. It didn't make sense to me. I was a good person. I worked very hard. I helped people. I was a good mom. I was a good grandmother. I was doing everything based on the blueprint of society. And so what was missing, Brother Grace, was the spiritual foundation that had gotten me all of the stuff. I forgot my first love. I walked away from my first love, Christ.
All right. I wanted to hear you say it. So here, I'm going to pause the show for just a moment. I think I've got this. I want people to be able to actually ask you questions. So 215-883, you are on with GD and Laura Poindexter. Do you have a question? Okay, so I guess 215-883 wants to just listen, which is fantastic. I'm loving it. Let's move on to 601-597. You are on with GD and Laura Poindexter. Do you have a question?
Hi, GD. Hi, Laura.
Hi. Madonna.
Hey, Laura. I just called in. I wanted to support her and just tell her how much respect that I have for hearing your testimony and your story, because, you know, me knowing you through meeting on About Me and, you know, us just meeting and, you know, in the spirit and finding that, you know, we just love for the Lord, I never knew your entire story. So I just have so much more respect for you, Laura, now. So thank you for sharing, you know.
Thank you, Madonna.
Yeah, I love you. Don't cry. You
she is so sweet. Yeah, well,
and
thank you, LaDon.
You're welcome.
Well, I love you, too, and you're welcome. Thanks for tuning in today.
You're welcome.
Okay. All right. All right, let's go for another. 803-318, you are on with Glenn and LaDonna Poindexter. Do you have a question?
Ashley, I don't have a question. This is Ashley Chambers. I was just listening in, and I was just calling.
Hey,
Ash. Hey, love. Oh, my gosh. This interview was so powerful. It was so touching. Like LaDonna said, I have so much respect to you. Thank you for what you're doing. Continue to do what you're doing. Continue to trust in God, and everything will just fall in place, and God bless you.
Thank you so much, Ashley.
Thanks a lot for tuning in, Ashley, and I'm gonna take one more because I want to give everybody a chance to talk to the phenomenal Laura Poindexter. 315-570, you are on with GD and Laura Poindexter. Do you have a question?
No, this is King Judas calling in to listen to this wonderful woman.
How
you doing, Laura?
Hi, King.
Hello. You are awesome.
Thank you so much.
You are so welcome.
I'm humbled.
Thank you.
Oh, God.
Thank you, King, for tuning in. Okay, so you are a light in the lives of others, you know, and I'm all choked up. I mean, I was choked up when you talked about the whole candle lighting experience and, you know, just to pay homage to those who have lost their lives in addiction. So we're going to continue. Since using was no longer an option, how did you face the adversity standing before you after you had to call out that son of a bitch, I'm sorry for saying that, that asshole who came on to you, I just can't stand it. So I know that you said you reconnected with Jesus. So what else did you do to maintain what you had attained in sobriety? How did you get through that?
Oh, man, I didn't do anything. Oddly enough, because I wanted to fight to keep that stuff, and I did not want to lose my stuff. It was defining me, and at least I thought it was defining me. Mm-hmm. But God was relentless in His to have me walk into my true destiny, and in that He would not let up. There were times when I battled verbally with God, and a lot of my poetry reflects that. And oftentimes when we are battling with God, God sits in stillness because He does not want to kindle His wrath against you. He's trying to teach you something, and He's hoping that you're going to get it, so He allows you to go through what you have to go through. Now, in all of this, I was never hungry. I was never homeless. I couldn't go to Macy's or Nordstrom's or Neiman's, but I had clothes. I could not eat lobster and filet mignon, but I had food.
Mm-hmm.
You understand what I'm saying?
I
was not in a wanting place. There were people who would have killed for the life that I was crying about.
Mm.
Oh, yeah.
I think that's profound. That's profound. There are people that would have killed for the life that you had. Here's something. In an effort to get you to love me, I eagerly became someone else. That comes from get to know me. In your own words, what does that mean?
Everybody loves a winner. And so I wanted to be Charlie Sheen. I wanted to be winning. I wanted to be winning because my blueprint, what I had saw, and in my messed up thinking, I believe that if I had it and if I was able to share it and if the bottles were flowing and if I could take you on vacation and if I could buy you nice things, you would be dedicated and loyal to me. But I came to soon realize that when everything was gone, the phone stopped ringing.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody knocked on my door.
Mm.
Nobody called to see about me. That's when I realized that these people that are calling in now, I ain't never seen these people before in my life.
Mm.
But these people know me. They know the true essence of me. I have nothing to give them but me.
Mm-hmm.
I had to develop a new way of thinking. I had to let go of all of the things that I had cherished to get this fulfillment of being still, Brother Grace, and just being, existing in the moment and understanding that I am wonderfully, wonderfully, gloriously made in the image of my Creator with nothing but me. I'm enough.
Mm. Enough indeed. Let's talk about your God. You have given me chill bumps throughout this whole thing. I've been on the verge of tears at any given moment during this interview. It's just fantastic and powerful, like the many callers have said when they were talking about what an inspiration you are just by being who you are. So let's talk about your writing. Do you have a poem that you can recite to us today?
Of course I do. I am always ready to recite, man. So
well,
big up.
well, you know what? Let's do this. So tell us what the title of the poem is, and then you go ahead on and you do your thing.
Okay. A lot of my poetry is responsive. That's what I titled it. That's what God led me to title it. And most of it is my rant and God's answers to my rants. And so they're two separate poems, but they are meant to be read together. And the first part is, who do you think you are? I really need to ask you, God, who do you think you are? I must confess I'm fed up with your mess. You've gone a tad bit too far. Why don't you and I take a walk down memory lane? You took my mother when I was 6 years old, and I still live with the pain. My father lost his ever-loving mind in response to losing his wife. I lost them both, and it really complicated my life. He shipped me off to my grandma's house to dwell in amongst her junk. While she was a good, God-fearing woman, her husband, he was a drunk. My entire world changed in the blink of an eye, and I just didn't know how to deal. I turned to drugs and hanging with thugs because I no longer wanted to feel. I was angry with you for a very long time, but I managed to trust you again. I put my hand in the palm of yours, and once again, I called you my friend. I've tried very hard to redeem myself. I've tried to do most things right, but it appears to me like it's never enough, and you constantly want to fight. What have I done to deserve this slaying? Not enough church, fasting, or praying? These recent events are relentless, disturbing, and quite bizarre. Do you take pleasure in pain without measure? God, who do you think you are? In peace. And this is God's answer. I am God. I am the Lord. I am God. The last thing you want is to make me go hard. I have put up with enough of your insolent prayers, your do's, your don'ts, your threats, and your dares. I am the creator of heaven and earth. Your intermittent discomfort cannot measure my worth. Who do you think kept you from day to day when you played Russian roulette with your life? Who do you think kept the death angel at bay more than once or twice? My hands were full trying to keep up with you and all of your miscreant behavior. This is what I do because my love is true, so respect me as your savior. As far as your mother, I know that you loved her, but her work on earth was done. She is dwelling with me, just waiting to see the woman that you will become. I owe you no more than you owe yourself, so put your hard feelings back on the shelf. I think that you do this much sooner than later. My patience is growing thin, and my wrath is growing greater. Your most prudent option at this very moment is to cast your cares upon me. I care for you so much more than you know, and I love you much more than you see. All that you've gone through and continue to endure purifies your tainted heart, removing thoughts obscure. I recognize that of all of your trials, this one is exceptionally hard. But if you stand still, continue to do my will, you will see that I am God. In peace.
Okay, I need a moment. Oh, God. All right, so when these poems, first of all, thank you so much. I'm going to get so much out of this. By the way, those of you who are listening, the broadcast is being recorded. So you can go back and listen to this interview over and over again, as I will. I'm going to listen to it as soon as I get through with the live show. So, Laura, this writing, when did it arrive at your feet?
Oh, my goodness. I was ready to give up, and when I say give up, I was at a point where I was contemplating suicide. I even in my addiction, you know, there is something about the addiction and recovery piece that suicide is always looming just because of all of this, the emotional roller coaster. But I was giving up, and I told God I was giving up, and I was done. I couldn't do it anymore. And that's when I heard him say very, very plainly, very softly over my sobbing and cursing and crying, he said, "Right." And I'm thinking to myself, I know God didn't just tell me. I know he's tripping right now. Okay, I know Jesus is tripping right now. And he said, "Right." He said it twice, and the second time he said it, I said, "I'm not writing. I don't have anything to write about." I was very adamant about that, and I was like, "How dare you ask me to do something for you? I'm not writing anything."
Mm.
And the third time, he said it again, but the third time, it fell in my inner ear. Picked up a pad and a pencil. I didn't even look for a pen, and I literally wrote on in for about 6 hours. Every title, every word, every line, God breathed on me. Mm. And after it was done, I said, "Now what am I going to do with it?" And he never answered me.
Mm.
And I continued to write, and I continued to write. And as I continued to be obedient, then he began to disclose his plan for my writing.
And what was his plan?
To be able to share that when God comes into your life, he comes into your life for the better, but there must be some crushing and some breaking up. You cannot put new wines into an old vat. When God shows his presence in a powerful way, it is for a powerful experience, and you can measure where he's going to exalt you to by understanding the depths of your despair.
Mm.
My writing, if I share it with you, if he puts me on a platform where I can share it with you, it will help you to understand God in his in his godliness, and why the way that he does things are so different, and so it appears to be complex. But God is a simple man. We are the ones who are complex.
You better go ahead on and preach this afternoon, my friend. You better go ahead on and preach. I have to tell you right now, it is not a doubt in my mind that God has touched you profoundly. So the question that I have next is something that I got from one of your, I think, out of your bio. You talk about the craving of subconscious mind to dominate your work. Can you help us understand exactly what that means?
Oh, absolutely. The ego is always right there wanting to dictate who and how you should be. It is the humble man that is the great person that lies within us.
Mm.
But in that humble man, you're going to have to do some things that are viewed as belittling, that is viewed as weak, that are viewed as how can you take it. You're gonna have to take some stuff to get where you're trying to go. And consciously, I'll be surging up, bro. I'll be surging up. But I have to continue to remind myself that it is not me, but it is he that is in me that makes me great. It has nothing to do with me. I do not have the wherewithal to do this.
Not where he's trying to take me. I might have known enough to get where I am, but I darn sure don't know enough to get where I'm trying to go.
Ooh. So question. The ego is a mother, I tell you. It gets in the way of a lot of things. Our ego can just be so overinflated. But I like how you talk about one thing that I hear that's really common is that as much as we put God through it or think we're putting God through it, he is always so very, very patient with us. So now you have these wonderful writings. Two questions. The first question, have you went to a spoken word events to actually share that in person with people?
Well, actually, I started doing the poetry online, and then I got blessed with my own radio show, and I have wonderful people like LaDonna, who comes on, Brother Judah, who came on when I first got my show. He did a whole training and everything. And so I'm sharing my poetry in kind of like little spurts. However, the vision is that that illustration that you see was actually created by a young woman in the UK. And so I would like to do a compilation of these poems with original illustrations, and I would like to birth a art collection because I want people who can't read or people who don't like poetry or people, I want this to have a visual partner with it. And so I would like to, within the beginning of 2015, do a crowdfunding. So I'm looking at various crowdfunding opportunities because I would definitely like to publish this compilation of poems that the Lord has given me and accompany these poems with a live art collection, art that people can buy and post up. And so when you don't feel like reading it, just walk by the picture and see me that be tearing off the outside dress to get to the inside me. And so that's what I hope to do. I've just been invited to the Los Angeles Black Book Expo by Miss Denise Lyles, and oh my God, this is such a blessing. I'm in Maryland. She's in Los Angeles. I don't have money to get to Los Angeles, and she says to me, "We're going to set up a Skype stream, and we're going to have you stream in and speak to our symposium." And so that is like huge for me. So God is just blessing. He's blessing.
Yeah, I tell you right now, that is amazing. And it definitely is so befitting of one who has lived the life and is on the other side of the deck of cards, like you mentioned, to actually be able to shed light and drop breadcrumbs along the way to help others find their way. So you mentioned the Blog Talk Radio show, and I want to talk about it for a moment. You're the producer and the host. So what is the name of the show, and when did it first air?
Oh, gosh, The Literary Corner. It's The Literary Corner, and The Literary Corner has been airing for about 45. We're a relatively new program for about 45 days, about a month and a half, and it just started with me wanting to give support to other aspiring writers. And all of the poetry shows that I've gone on were great, but I wanted it to be a cleaner platform. I wanted it to be a cleaner platform for a Christian writer. And so I started with that, and I just started meeting fabulous people. Then I met authoress Tanya Wilson, who was a guest on my show, and we collaborated. We're like one soul, one spirit, and she came on board, and now we have the Recovery Corner under the Literary Corner. I met writer Andre Carter, who was on my show. He and I collaborated, and now we have Masterminds of the Grind, and that's under the Literary Corner. And most recently, I landed a collaboration with On the Rise magazine with Miss So Unique and Scholar the Artist. Their magazine is launching hard copy January 2015. Erykah Badu is on the cover. I'm in between the sheets of that magazine, and that magazine is now a part of the Literary Corner on the Rise Radio Magazine. And I'm speechless. Like he said, if you be still, continue to do my will, you will see that I am God. And what I tell you, when God give you a promissory note, honey, it's good.
I just love hearing you talk. Oh my God, you were born, literally born for this. And most certainly, your work in the efforts to try to change people's lives, you know, in addition to the trials and tribulations that you lived through, have made you this wonderful woman and this fireball of energy. So for anybody out there listening who want to become a guest on the show, how do they get in touch with you?
Oh, sure, guys. You can hit me on Facebook, which is actually my social media outlet of choice. You can go to www.facebook.com/LauraWritesForTheSoul. You can inbox me there. Be sure to like my page. Give me the thumbs up, everybody. inbox me there. Tell me what's going on with you, and I'll connect with you. You can also get in contact with me at LinkedIn, www.linkedin.com/LKP. Connect with me. Twitter at Miss Resourceful. And just definitely look for me on Facebook. That's like the best way. And the Literary Corner now is airing on Monday night from 8 to 10 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. It is now airing on Tuesday night with On the Rise magazine. That's going to be from 10 p.m. to 12 a.m. Do not forget my lovely, wonderful sister, authoress Tanya Wilson on the Literary Corner, Recovery Corner. She comes on Sunday at 7 p.m. and author Andre Carter Saturday at 7 p.m. And all of these are the spawns and the babies of the Literary Corner. So check me out on Facebook, Laura Writes for the Soul.
All right. I just love how articulate you are. I just kind of like my eyes are lowered and I'm just all into you, okay? You have just been such a phenomenal guest on this show. Most certainly when people go back and listen to this, you know what I like to do is I like to go and look at the numbers, and then when I hit F5, it updates, and you see people just constantly going back listening to the show. This is definitely going to be one of the shows. To be quite honest, when we talk about addiction here on The Touch of Grace, those are the bigger shows. So that tells me that there are people out there looking for a light, and my God, you most certainly are. So here's the question, and I hope it doesn't choke you up, but if it does, it's okay. What would you tell 13-year-old Laura Poindexter, if you could go back in time, what advice would you give her? What words of wisdom would you say to her?
Oh, okay. Nobody's ever asked me that before. I would tell her that she does not have to find light in darkness. As a matter of fact, it is impossible to find light in darkness. And so don't go that way, because you are seeking light. And in order to get that thing which you seek, don't go in the cave. It's cold, it's lonely, and it's dark in the cave. I would tell her to hold on to light and life, because that is ultimately where we all want to be.
I think that's wonderful. You have been a phenomenal guest here on A Touch of Grace. And in the spirit of the lighting of the candles that you did, we're having a cyber lighting of the candles right now for those who have lost their way or lost their lives in the fight to stay clean and live a sober-free life. For all of those who have lost their lives, we salute you today, and we want to say that your living was not in vain. Because of you, other people will find strength to know that the final outcome, if we don't stop, is definitely 6 foot of dirt on top of us or being scattered across the ocean somewhere. So if you're in a fight of addiction, there is hope out there for you, but you have to really want it. So I just want to give you some final words for today. Laura, what would you like to leave the listeners with today?
You are your best you without the stuff. You have been gloriously and wonderfully made. If anybody tells you any different, don't doubt yourself. Doubt them. When somebody shows you who they are, believe them. Oftentimes, in order to get to your destiny, you're going to have to travel by yourself. You're going to have to leave some stuff behind. Brother Gray, do know that as long as you have God, you're never alone. But in order to get where you need to be, you're going to have to unpack that bag, them bags, that bag, that bag. You can't take that with you where you're trying to go.
Mm-hmm. Mm, you can't take it with you where you're trying to go. Mm-hmm. Well, my sister, I have to tell you, you have just been interviewed on GD's A Touch of Grace. What's one of the best Block Talk radio shows on the net?
GD Touch of Grace.
Oh, man. I tell you, you are... Thank you for that. And I didn't even have to pay anything for that. Just open my heart up to you. And most certainly you have touched me in so many ways today. And I just want to say thank you for being you. Anytime you want to come back to the show, you already have my numbers. You know how to hit me up. You just say, GD, I'm ready. And GD is going to open up that velvet rope for you, okay?
Thank you, GD, for the platform. Thank you for your spirit, your open heart, and for sharing all so much of yourself with all of us. I love you, and I'm humbled. Thank you for allowing me to share my story.
You're welcome. You have a wonderful afternoon, and God's continued blessings to you, Laura Poindexter.
Tonight.
All right, night-night. All right, everybody, if you've listened to this entire show, you had to have gotten something out of it. I have to tell you, be you an addict, or be you a loved one dealing with an addict. There's a lot of good information that Ms. Laura Poindexter has left with us today. Summer 2014 continues to be in full effect here on A Touch of Grace, so do look for my postings about the dates and times for future shows here on A Touch of Grace. Special thanks go out to the grand supporters of A Touch of Grace, George Livingston, celebrity photographer. He's been at like 14 or 15 American Music Awards, Grammys Awards, but he's turned into a pretty good friend to me. Snowman, celebrity security and former bodyguard for James Brown for over 20 years, is also another great friend. And also my friends at World Media, who just continue to show their unyielding support of the show. And last but certainly not least, my brother in creativity as well as in recovery, Lewis Randy Rand Wilkerson, is the grand sponsor of A Touch of Grace. He's the inspiring man behind the book Coffee with God by Randy Rand. He's in Philly right now, and he's out there with the big old NA conference, and he's just been working down that bucket list. So, Rand, I love you much, man. Thank you so much for supporting me during those dry times. You know, I couldn't have done it without you. So if you haven't checked out his wisdom, Google Lewis Randy Rand Wilkerson, and you will find his Coffee with God. Go out and support him as well as all the artists that Laura Poindexter talked about that is on her show as well. And so now, you know, Laura said this, and when she said this during the interview, I had to catch myself. I'm like, oh, my God, that's exactly how I feel. In the words of the late Maya Angelou, always remember this, when someone shows you who they are the first time, believe them and always know this, GD loves you very much. And since we're talking about belief, why don't we go ahead and end the show with Kirk Whalum and Layla Hathaway, Make Me a Believer.
I believe he can. So what I choose to believe can always work out fine. It's all in my mind. I'll think of his grace and imagine his life. Imagine his life and learn how to love him, believe in him, we believe his believing right. Yeah, yeah, yeah. I wanna live, wanna learn, wanna love you, Lord. So make me a believer.
That's Layla Hathaway and Kevin Williams.
You're listening to author G.D. Grace's A Touch of Grace,
Literary
Magic, on Blog Talk Radio.
Blog Talk Radio.